You're now listening to The Limitless, the podcast between this is Jason Halsey, and this week a return conversation with a semi-regular participant. It goes all the way back to The Limitless number 31 and Diamond. Is that about wine?
I just poured myself a little red wine because
I have a no drinking policy. You didn't know that?
Okay, I won't touch it then. Do you?
Yeah. For the podcast. Yeah.
All right, I won't touch it. There was a special at the liquor store on this nice wine that I like. Okay.
So anyway, I did read your blog post. Whether we get to that or not, I mean, probably a good chance we will, because it's obviously seems like it's quite central to the fragmented picture of your past that you're putting together. But I wanted to start there in general, because you mentioned, well, I had this dream about you. That was what sparked it, wasn't it? And in the dream, we were going, I'm remembering it now, there was this third woman, and she was coming and going a bit, and we went up this hill, we were following a trail of clues, and at the top of the hill there was this sort of figure of a man, like maybe it was carved in wood, or two-dimensional kind of figure of a man, I think he was bearded, and the man, I'm having to fill in the gaps a bit, but I think the man signified somebody in the past who'd been involved in MK Ultra, and I was realizing, or you were telling me, no, I was realizing that I had been part of MK Ultra as a child, and it was very, it felt very real, even though I don't actually believe that, because I don't have any evidence, so it'd be silly to believe it, but I don't disbelieve it either, I just don't know. Anyway, that was a dream, so I sent you the dream, and you mentioned that you'd been having memories come up,
right.
Pieces, missing pieces, you weren't very specific, so I just thought we could start there, like what, because it's been a while since we spoke, so. Where are you at now in terms of piecing the Humpty Dumpty of your past together again?
Where am I? I don't know. I was thinking I was hitting, I was kind of hitting bottom, you know, or getting to the bottom of it. I don't know if you ever get to the bottom of it all, because, well, in my case, I think most of it happened when I was really young, and then I think I was taken out of it by my parents at about age, you know, early teens, and a memory block was installed so that I couldn't access, which I think is normal for kids who were in it. You know, they certainly don't want you remembering, or I mean, if you do remember, you'll become dysfunctional, you'll become crazy, and you won't be able to live probably with the memory. So they, I think they wiped my memory. So then I went on and was really another person after, I don't know, they even sent me to another school. Some of it's memory is you're aware of, and then things you forget or you don't look at that are still there, and then there's those spontaneous like a dream, you know, something comes up that you weren't expecting at all that fills you in. That's intuition, but a lot of it is just logic and fitting together what you know already. Anyway, what was the question?
Well,
yeah, so I had something to say though about your dream.
Yeah.
Just what came to me. is that we may have a person in common who would have been a key figure. Do you want me to name that person?
You can name them if you want to, yeah.
He's no longer on this plane.
Yeah.
Ted Hughes.
Right. Okay, who I met as a child.
Yeah. And who was from Yorkshire. And the connection, and what made me think of that just now, but that thought had occurred to me before, someone I was going to mention to you. I have a connection to him through a bearded man who was I don't know what to call him. He was a kind of a mentor, but in a very edgy kind of way, very uncomfortable way. And I believe he knew all about my childhood MKUltra past and would taunt me with little references, you know. And he was he had met, as it turns out, I found out, he was sort of obsessed with Ted Hughes. He wanted to be Ted Hughes. He would write to Ted Hughes. He was a poet himself. He is still alive, this man. His name is Michael. And just basically tried to model himself on Ted Hughes. So there was a period where he tried to model me as Sylvia Plath, and then it kind of became Emily Dickinson. So he eventually told me, in about 1990, we went on a trip together, and we gave poetry readings in Massachusetts. And we went to Sylvia Plath, we went to Smith College, and we were giving a reading at Smith College to a group of students. And Sylvia Plath had been to Smith, and she had taught there in the 50s. And she was, you know, a great light there and so on. So that he began telling the story of how a great poet, he didn't name him, had come to Montreal when he, Michael, was 16, and they'd had sex. And he told us to the room. The poet was about 30 and was already famous, and it couldn't have been anyone else, you know, than Hughes. And it took me a long time actually to figure that out, because he didn't name the guy. But basically he told this group of young women, he loved opening up in front of young women, because they're so receptive, you know, and they won't judge you, or I don't know. Anyway, and he told them about this. So basically, yeah, at age 16, he was initiated. And there's no doubt in my mind that it was Hughes, because Hughes at that time was living not that far. He was living in Massachusetts, I think. Hmm. Anyway, at that time, I mean, when I figured out the dates, about 1960, that would have been, then, you know, this is really like personal stuff, I think. Maybe it's not suitable for it. But in any case, so I think Hughes was a kind of lightning rod, even in meeting a child. You said he patted you on the head and said, Jake is a good name.
Jake is a good name. It's like desperate. I think you mentioned Desperate Dan or comic books, Desperate Dan comics or the Beano. I remember Desperate Dan, but I don't know what the connection between Desperate Dan and Jake would be. But it was anyway, he was saying it was like a cowboy comic book cowboy kind of name, I think was what he was saying. Yeah.
A dangerous Dan, but desperate.
Desperate Dan was a comic character in the Beano, which was, there was the Beano and the Dandy. Dandy, of course, has all this meaning now. They were the two, like Pepsi and Coke, of kids' comic books back then, although I don't think they were competing. I think they were the same company. And Desperate Dan was in, I think he was in the Dandy, but anyway, that was the reference. And it was a... it was some sort of book, a literary event that we were invited to because my parents ran the children's bookshop. And I might have even only gone because I knew that Ted Hughes was there. And I knew Ted Hughes because of Iron Man, because that was my favorite book as a kid.
All right. And what year that would have been in the 80s or
No, that would have been in the
70s?
70s, early 70s. I would have to
You were just
guess.
little.
I would guess I was about 7 or 8.
Right.
I would guess, yeah. Yeah. But just coming back to what you just said, just to clarify, you're saying that you think that your friend or your mentor at that time, the bearded man, well, he wasn't bearded at that time, you think he was initiated,
Well, not at that, not at that age.
yeah, at 16 by Ted Hughes, and that's the context for this, having sex with Ted Hughes, was that it was an initiation.
Yeah, I've never said this to anyone before. I don't know why I'm saying it in a podcast, except that, it's just something. It seems obvious to me, given his sense of total identification with Ted Hughes is an almost religious, and he's made a lot out of it during. I don't want to give his last name, but I've already given away enough by telling you his name is Michael. But yeah, and I think that's how literary world has functioned for a long time. I think that's the thing about influence and successors. You have, and what do you call that? Anyway, when you have acolytes and
Protege, yeah. It's like the
proteges.
Greek, this is a Greek system, isn't it? Or it's similar. My stepfather, the man who ran the bookshop with my mother, was called Michael, and he had a beard. So
Could have been him.
there's a parallel. I don't think it
Or there
was
was
him.
no.
I don't think it was him. But we're talking about things that are going on in the real world or in the real past, but also have this archetypal template to them, I think. And specifically when we're talking about dreams as well, we don't know. Like I can believe that archetypally speaking, I was involved in MK Ultra, because well, weren't we all, as you've said, and some more than others. So an MK Ultra has become an archetype. How literal it is, I don't know. And then so you describing this, maybe a very literal experience for you, the bearded man and Ted Hughes. But for me, it may be more archetypal. I don't know. My stepfather Michael was also friends, not friends with, but he knew Lord Mountbatten. He mentioned that he knew him in India, and of course now we know that Lord Mountbatten was, friends with Jimmy Savile and involved in the Kinkora boys' home sexual abuses and
Yeah, we know
stuff.
those stories. Yeah.
So these things aren't—they're not evidence of criminal complicity, but they are evidence or clues to, intersections in this archetypal, this hidden, this parallel world that we're embedded in, that most of us either forget. I suppose we forget, because I think all of us are aware of it at some point in our life, aren't we? That we're part of a hidden world that
All of them,
corresponds,
maybe
all of
some of
us.
us.
Well, yeah, maybe.
Well, I've certainly met enough people who seem to have no idea that any such thing, that I've learned to keep my mouth shut, But yes, there's a lot of that going on, and there are a lot of us, who have gone through that, process or whatever it is, some kind of initiation, I think that happens. And I was thinking today, it's a little bit like just a little bit of a world of dark magic too, where names and numbers mean something. And just as we're talking, something came up when you brought up Dan. That's definitely a name that is part of this. I'm beginning to think that MK has some connection to Michael. I don't mean that, the Michael I was talking about. I mean the archetype, the name Michael, and the name Dan is another sort of an archetype. It might be connected to the tribe of Dan. It might be. And MK, and then their numbers, and those, someone once said to me, it's all the name and number game, and generally that world is organized. Well, that's, I guess that's Masonic. It's not something I really want to be I don't want to be good at all that or adept or knowledgeable particularly. I'll listen to it and explore it, but I don't subscribe or I don't join. I don't sign up, you know, to be really good at it and then begin to control, you know, doesn't interest me. I think that's the magical world, doesn't draw me in.
Yeah, well, it doesn't interest me anymore, but I got pulled into it, and part of my cultural deconditioning that I started with Seen and Not Seen, I guess I'm tracing, I got very into the specific Masonic occultist keys and all that and learning them in my 20s, but what I've seen is I can trace that fascination or that enrapturement back to much earlier, which the formative influences on me as a children were these texts, movies, etc., songs, David Bowie, that were perhaps designed, you know, Masonically. I don't know to what extent.
Yeah.
It's a spectrum, isn't it? But yeah. Thinking of the Iron Man, like I said, that was probably, well, along with Winnie the Pooh and Roald Dahl, another intelligence agent, who's married to a beautiful woman, etc. There's some definite parallels between Ted Hughes and Roald Dahl.
Yeah.
What was I saying? Yeah, those books really profoundly influenced me. A.A. Milne was also intelligence agent.
Who?
So A.A. Milne, and yeah, A.A. Milne, the author of Winnie the Pooh, also had intelligence connections. So, and the Iron Man, of course. Have you read the Iron Man?
No, there's a lot of things I haven't, but I was just reading about it the other day, so refresh my memory.
Yeah, well, I think I haven't seen The Iron Giant, but I think it's pretty closely based on the book. And the book is it begins with the Iron Man is broken up into all these different fragments. I don't know if it even explains why, and he has to put himself back together. It starts with a hand crawling around, and the hand finds an eye, so the hand can now see, and then finds other parts, and just gradually puts himself back together again. And it ends with the Iron Man saving the planet by competing, doing this competition with this black sort of Lovecraftian entity that comes from outer space to destroy the Earth or whatever it comes for, and they have this bet that they can both, you know, fly to the sun, and anyway, Iron Man wins the bet. So it's a very archetypal narrative, and it starts with this fragmentation of the psyche, and the Iron Man also is like the constructed identity, you know, the defense system. Now Iron Man is the most popular character in Hollywood, so
right.
It's definitely something.
Well, I've been away, and I don't go to Hollywood movies. Who's the writer? Was it Roald Dahl? No.
No, this was Ted Hughes's, I think it was his only children's book, because of course he was famous as a poet. And he was poet laureate, which is the royally elected poet for a period.
Yes.
So clearly favored highly, you know, at the highest level.
Yeah. No, it's very. Well, at one point I was, you know, I did a lot of research anyway. That's about 20 years ago or longer, researching Sylvia Plath. And I even went to meet her former upstairs neighbor, I guess. Was she upstairs or downstairs? Anyway, what was his name? He lived in Bedford in England. I went and visited him.
Oh, I have a very close friend in Bedford. I once made a film called Escape from Bedford.
All right. Anyway, I even went so far as to, you know, go to visit places where she'd lived and sort of try to piece together her life. And I came to the conclusion, well, you know, a lot of the things you research, you realize you can't really do much with it. Because they'll stop you. I sort of found out, talked to people who said there was a huge cover-up, and you know, Hughes burned her diaries because there were things in there that he didn't want anyone to know, and he lied, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. And she was, she was definitely MK Ultra. I taught when I was teaching at university. I didn't even know this MKUltra background, but I chose to teach The Bell Jar, which was her novel, to a couple of classes there. I just had them reading it, and it was only later I realized she's absolutely an MKUltra victim, you know, and in Massachusetts at the time, and went to the schools and met all the people, and all it's an autobiographical novel about a woman who has a nervous breakdown, but it seems to start with a bad LSD trip, you know, in 1953. I mean, the world of journalism, the world of publishing, everything is in there. All the she wanted to be the next J.D. Salinger, you know, a female J.D. Salinger. She's absolutely, you know, totally steeped in MK Ultra, and then she committed suicide in 1963, right? And so, anyway, so it just once you know, those are some keys. Those are very important keys to have, you know, the MK Ultra key, so important. Once you've got that, once you know enough of the history, the background, then so many mysteries, you know, open up. So she's one. So she was connected to him, and people blamed him for her death. Although I don't, yeah, I guess he was definitely a trigger cause of it. But, you know, I was told by the downstairs neighbor's name was Trevor something, said Hughes is absolutely a Mason and everyone's terrified of him. And his sister is a witch. She died not that long ago. Was it Al? What is her name? Not Bronwyn. Maybe it was Bronwyn. I don't remember.
Ted Hughes' sister.
Sister Alwyn, or what was her name? Anyway. Yeah. No, that's not right. But anyway, she had a kind of Celtic, Druidic kind of name, first name. And she was his, she stood by him all, you know, right to the end. And I guess was his literary executor or something. Anyway.
Thank you.
So have you retrieved any particular memories since we last spoke?
No, I had that. I had a big, well, basically acknowledging a memory last year. So that gets us into an area. Oh, the blog that I wrote. The memory came up. The memories don't come up that often. Maybe you found that, or dreams. I don't have very many anymore. But I used to dream vividly about. I used to have MK Ultra dreams when I was 18, 19, about groups of hooded men who had who had destroyed my family. It was in a wartime situation, and four of them being raped, serially raped by four of them, and all of them wearing these black capes and hoods, and then having some kind of enlightenment experience at the, at, with the fourth one, who happened to be the same poet I've just been talking about. This was when I was so young. I was 18 or something when I began, and seeing myself in a what?
When you had the dreams, you were 18.
It was like a ritual, way back 1969, 1970, when I first was starting to, well, I was becoming autonomous and, having connecting with things, and I was immediately drawn into this world that my parents were trying to keep me out of, I guess. They would have preferred to isolate me in the suburbs, I guess, but that couldn't go on that way. So I went downtown to university, and then I just began stumbling on this, you could say underground kind of, it's almost a geometrical almost world of the downtown, where I would have a magical encounters with people, or I'd meet people and they would, draw me into situations. I began writing poetry, began going to certain clubs and bars and meeting, connecting with people. Leonard Cohen was around at that time, so there's a whole Masonic geography of downtown Montreal that I used to very much participate in, but I never, but not as a knowledgeable person, not as an insider, more as just a kind of a, somebody who wandered in and just was sensitive. So, and then I had these kind of archetypal dreams about seven-roomed mansions and, stages of being initiated and going from room to room and memorizing in this dream, memorizing every object in the room because that was the step, and then going on to the next room and memorizing every object, and until I got to the sixth room, which was, I guess, on the anyway, the sixth room was complete darkness. And having passed through that, at some point I got through that and I ended up in the sky in a kind of the seventh, I guess that was the seventh or the eighth, I don't know, but anyway, where which was true love, which was a complete blue kind of sky, godlike kind of, and looking down on the at that point I looked down and I saw the owner of the mansion, who was this man in a black cape running around on the roof. The house was burning down. The flames were, licking at his feet. He was on his, and he would not leave the roof. He did not want to leave that level. He wouldn't come up into the sky, where, where you could only be if you had a lover, a true, if you understood love, true love. And actually, I think there were two keys before I got to that point. There were two keys that were, and one was silver and one was gold, and you had to somehow possess these keys or understand these keys, and then you were released from it all. That's seems to me, I don't know where I got that. It was a dream, So that was my teen years, my late teens, and that, around that time there was quite a poetry scene. There was a lot going on. A lot of famous poets were coming to town, and they would give readings, and I would go. And now I see all of English literature as being some kind of Freemasonic structure, architecture that they, that they indoctrinate you with if you go to university. So I didn't stick with my honors English program. I switched to history because I felt very uncomfortable in English. anyway, it's my story. What did you ask again?
I don't think I did. Oh, about memories. Yeah, about if any specific memories.
All right. I have some more, but I haven't. My real, yeah, if you're patient enough, but go ahead, ask me something else. But I do have a present situation that's really quite interesting that's going on.
Right. Well, I guess I was wondering, or going to a more sort of general question, which has to do with, if I can even articulate it, do you feel that you were being conditioned and programmed for a certain role or to be part of something and that didn't happen? And if so, do you feel as though you're trying to find your way back to a life that you were never allowed to live by these interferences?
Yes. Next question. Yes, that's a really good summary of where things are at. And I was, I had a habit, and I always have had it, and I must have got it from my father or something. I would always say no. You know, there's a French pop song, La Poupée qui fait no. You know that song, eh? C'est une poupée qui fait non, 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 toute la journée. Elle fait non, 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 non.
What's it mean? What's the English translation?
It's, there's a doll, well, she's a doll who always says no. Huh. And all day long, all she says is no. No, 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 no. You know, and really, it's a very monotonous song. But,
wow. And that was you, huh?
Kind of catchy, though. I had a tendency, and I would be invited into these clubs. I wasn't always rejected. I was sometimes invited and given a role to play. And I had a tendency to go a certain distance and then try to get out, you know, the door. I try to sneak back out or just say, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not going any farther. And that's how I've ended up in a motel, in Kamloops. That's pretty much it. I think it's not a bad way to go through life, though.
Because you move around a lot.
Yeah, I have to move around a lot. I never have to, I think I've escaped slavery, the kind of slavery that people, I think, is very much part of the system that people are always trying to get you involved in, you know. So I think I've, to some extent, avoided. But at the same time, also, I've somehow avoided close relationships, I guess, too, that maybe you need to go through. But I don't actually, you know, if I look out the window now, I'm up in that sky, and there's blue. I feel I've come to that place in life now. You know, you were saying, was it in your last, today, this morning podcast, you said you're in a place where you feel more and more joy. I mean, I'm kind of in the same place. I don't know why exactly. I think it's just having reached a point where you can say, oh, okay, I look back, oh, I see what happened, you know, and why that had to happen. And it makes me happy, you know, to have reached a point where you can actually see it. And so, yeah.
So you're still trying to work out what happened to you, or is that no longer a driving?
Things are coming down to some, you know, it's not very mystical anymore. My life is, it's quite factual and logical. Mm-hmm. You know, we have our hopes and dreams and childhood fantasies, and we fall in love, and we wish for the world to be wonderful and magical and so on. And it is. And then I think what saves us at the end are often just the cold, hard facts, mm-hmm, of what happened. And so wherever there are disappointments and obstacles, you're saved by knowing why things did not turn out as you hoped when you were 5 years old or whatever, you know, or when you were just a pure little heart, you know, facing life and being open to everything. That inevitably is, your heart is broken. You can't go through life with that type of heart. And you go through stages. And maybe at the end you recover that. I think usually in a relationship, that's how it happens. So.
I think that's probably true, generally true, when it's happening in a relationship, it's not the thing that we thought that was going to happen either, you know?
Right.
Because that's also a big part of the dream, and maybe not a 5-year-old, but certainly a 12-year-old, of, you know, living happily ever after with one's prince or princess.
Yes, a turquoise Cinderella syndrome.
Yeah, I picked out a turquoise Cinderella kind of princess last night in doing a constellation, but it's the character from Frozen. But anyway, she was wearing turquoise. So, yeah, why turquoise?
I don't know. I'm wearing a turquoise. I'm going to show you my... Wait a second. I've got my turquoise. You know, I bought it for €1.
Yeah.
Bracelet. I have it on all the time. Now I can accept turquoise. It used to be, as a child, turquoise, I think, was my favorite color. Then I saw a Disney movie with Cinderella many years ago. I was babysitting someone's kid, and she was, you know, she was 8, and we were watching Disney, and we watched the Cinderella thing, and I thought it was the most toxic, you know, movie for kids to watch. It was something very much about, now I would say, very much about mind control and conditioning the little girl to be a passive. There's something wrong with that. I don't know. But anyway, just totally a passive vessel.
Well, she goes from a slave to being a princess. And you could say they're both, there's kind of two sides of the monarch, the MK Ultra programming. Yeah. And they're the same. The princess is also a slave. So that, and yes, that's kind of what I was feeling when we were talking now, is that I got installed with a drive and the programming to be a somebody in the world.
Yeah.
But I rejected that in an attempt to get free because I sensed that that would trap me. But I still had the program running. So essentially I've been... I've been very driven not to become the thing that I was programmed to become, but then that drive is just a negative drive. So then I also became kind of the opposite of what I was programmed to become, which was just another version of it, really. I just became my own gonzo version, Lucifer, you know, the one. I even took the stuff from movies, you know, I did it consciously thinking that I had control over it. My brother did a similar thing because, yeah, I'm doing it consciously. I'm not just following my programming, but I was, because it was a deeper level.
Well, that's really interesting, too, you know. But they didn't tell you in school, you're going to grow up and become Lucifer. But they gave you Luciferian programming to become a powerful figure or someday a respected.
Yes, and they gave me, and they, you know, David Bowie songs about Aleister Crowley leads me to Crowley and Castaneda. And so on, you know, it's so deeply embedded, these archetypes and these values.
Right. It's unavoidable. I mean, I don't know, anyone who thinks that they can just be Christian and avoid Lucifer, not deal with it and it's someone else's problem, you know, or that we can't be that anymore. We can't, you know, that's kind of the turquoise reality. I think, isn't it? It's so complicated and confusing, though.
Well, I don't know if it is, though. I think we can complicate, we definitely can get complicated because we're fragmented and there's all these pieces and they don't fit together. So it seems it's got to be very complex. But if and when they come together, then it's very simple. Like Humpty Dumpty's just an egg, right? He's not all these pieces. And I mean, what we're talking about, you know, when Ewan Cameron was doing the psychic driving, as far as I can gather, there were two ways to traumatize somebody and implant with them an absolute unbending will to be successful. One was just telling them, you know, that you are great, you are a success. You see this in childhood, you know, imprinting, so that it all get bigged up and they'd feel special and they'd pursue that destiny. But the other way was to tell them that you're nothing, you're shit, and to implant that into their psyche,
Yeah.
and so they would do everything to override that, right?
That's true. I do you know that story about me? That's what I heard in my I heard you and Cameron's voice in my head at night. I don't know how, through some kind of electronic. I mean, I'd be in my bed at home in the suburbs. But I would hear him say hundreds of times, "You're no good, you will fail, you will never succeed at anything." I don't know if did you know that?
I think
And yet I have told
that's
you.
probably where I got
That's where you got it.
maybe where I got it, because I don't remember reading that, but I've read bits and pieces here and there, and it just makes sense to me that if you had this constant loop playing in your head that you were no good, you'd be trying everything you could to prove it wrong or to compensate for
Right, you would.
it.
You would,
And
but I think you'd also have a strong sense of nihilism, that if it isn't worth. That if there are people like that programming you, then what would be the point of succeeding on their terms anyway? I mean, I think, it's definitely a dual message. You'd want to defeat them. Such an aggressive, awful thing to say to someone. Anyway, I read later, I found out many years later that that was one of the programming tropes. That's one of definite word for word. That's what he had on tapes, and I heard it in my head. Absolutely. As a child, yeah, and I had was playing in my head that when I wrote my grade 7 history exam and I got like a 95 or something on that exam. I just was, yeah, I was determined it wasn't going to get me. I remember doing, I remember once that was, yeah, and once I got through that, I said, okay, and I never heard it again after that.
Not even in your own head.
No, it wasn't. I still don't know. My brother claimed he heard it too, but he couldn't make out the words, but he heard the voice. I think he wrote
Well,
down the message.
I meant by head in your own head, as in your own thoughts, because that's certainly a
Yeah.
message I've heard many times in my own voice, in my own head.
Do you tend to say negative things to yourself or
Well,
positive?
both. That's the thing. It seems that there's good cop, bad cop, isn't it? They reinforce each other. I think it's probably quite common, actually. I was thinking Peter Sellers. I mean, in terms of background or being raised, Peter Sellers, his mother absolutely doted on him. Would do, anything he wanted, he got it, and so he grew up that kind of pathology that basically he was the center of the universe, and no doubt that helped him to become a superstar that reinforced that belief, but it also helped him to be a psychopath who had a complete meltdown. But I think also his father was probably either not there at all or was just kind of
Well,
not valuing him. So if you get super validation from your mother and none at all from your father, you've got both going on, right? You still need
right.
desperately to prove yourself, but you've also got this massively inflated ego that you can, of entitlement that anything that you want should be yours. That's a
Right. Well,
deadly.
I could s the father would have been a limiting force. If the father had been really a father and had been present, he would have been opposing the mother. He would have been telling him, "No, you're not so good, and if you want to get to be really good, you got to do this, this, and this." That's what fathers do. But an absent father is like a vacuum. So then the megalomania would flourish.
Or an abusive father, because that doesn't
Right.
balance it out. If it's
Yeah.
too negative,
Right. Yeah.
then the child just stays in the mother's field, because that's the only place that's safe, right?
Yeah, that's another one too. Yeah.
So I think, you say it's complicated, and it certainly is for, as I say, when we're victim and imprinted by it, like the culture is incredibly complex, but nature, in a way, nature's quite simple. I mean, you can break it down and make it complicated, but even the planets and the stars, they're all moving in this geometrical way. It's actually a pretty simple system, more simple than a watch.
Oh yeah, I mean yeah. Once you get out of the human, all the human systems, then things are pretty good, I think.
Yeah, the socialized human, I think
Yeah.
it is. All right,
Well, yeah. ambitious, you know, driven,
traumatized.
Traumatized, organizationally minded, you know, calculating, all that.
Yeah, robotized.
Robotized. Yeah.
I think of you, Mama, with a game spoon. I talk to you, Papa, with another shoe. I see my brother fucking my lover too. I see my lover fucking my brother too. Said to Mama, no universidad. But she says to Papa, you're gonna break my heart. I ain't nothing, I'm gonna take my time. Feeling alright, living my be the wife.
It's just full of little scenes. I've been doing a lot of traveling, but where I am now, do you want to hear? Did you?
Well, you tell me in the email, but what you mean in an inner sense, where you are.
Where I am now in Kamloops, British Columbia, at the high desert, you know.
Yeah.
I'm taking a course at the university.
Yeah. And
I've told you about that, and the university is called TRU, right? Thompson Rivers University.
Right.
Nice name. I like the name.
What are you studying?
I'm taking one course. I used to teach here. I was writer in residence here about 20 years ago. So I have a connection with the town. I was here for 2 years. I liked it a lot. And with the university. And now I'm taking a course here with with Andrew Luke Oldham, who was the manager of the Rolling Stones in their early days and the person who gave them their bad boy image, which is what I wrote about in my recent blog entry. I'm trying to write, but it's coming very slowly. And he's giving a quite an amazing series of lectures over this winter called Rock Dreams. And essentially he gets up and he comes very prepared, and he's written two books that they're quite interesting about, is very autobiographical, called Stoned and Too Stoned. And he's a good writer, incredible recall. And he went through, I'm learning about him. I'm getting to feel kind of fond of him. he was their manager. He's the one who really set them off on the course of being bad boy, the opposite of the Beatles, and I guess is that essentially down the road that would become, you know, satanic. There's a few, he quit in 67 and or they got rid of him and they took Alan Klein as their manager, and it was just around the time they did their that album that everybody hated called Their Satanic Majesty's Request. So just as you were being born, 1967, the Stones went on down this road that nobody liked. So then they went back to being a blues band and a macho,
They were still competing with the Beatles by that time as well, weren't they? Because Beatles had Sgt. Pepper in 67, I think.
Right. And, yeah. Their Satanic Majesty's Request was considered to be a pale copy of Sgt. Pepper. It had a complicated psychedelic album cover and, kind of experimental music.
Yeah.
Now people are starting to value it more, saying there's more to that album than we thought at the time.
So this Alden fellow, did they have a not bad boy image? Did they have a more Beatles-like image, and then he came in and roughed them up? No,
they didn't. He came in I guess, 65, 64. I think he met them in 64, 65. And there's a film called Charlie Is My Darling, which kind of shows them at that period. I guess late 64 is when he met them. And then they started... He began forming them, yes, as the bad boys of rock and roll in late 64, which is when they hit North America. That's when I saw them for the first time on the Ed Sullivan shows in October 1964. So that was when Oldham was already their manager. And he sort of sent them off on the... Yeah, he decided they had to distinguish themselves from the Beatles. They didn't have much original material at the time. They were really kind of just a band that came up, but it was on the strength of their... They were good musicians in their own, primitive way, and Jagger's incredible stage presence. So he just kind of packaged that and made them ugly, and then told them they have to be ugly, and they had to act ugly, and they had to... Which, they weren't really, but...
No, but maybe compared to the Beatles.
It had to be. They never wore uniforms. Beatles wore suits. Stones wore dirty sweatshirts,
Of course, the Beatles, they got rougher around the edges soon after that, after Sgt. Pepper. So they probably ended up competing with the Stones. They had to become edgier.
I don't know. The Beatles, you see, I'm one of these people, these lunatics who think that Paul died in 66.
Well, my wife is another of those lunatics, so in good company.
And once you, once you adopt that as a theory, then so many things begin to fall into place.
Uh-huh.
And he would have been one of the first of the murdered rock stars. And then came Brian Jones, then came Jimi Hendrix, and Janis Joplin, and Jim Morrison. By the end, after those five big stars were murdered, I think everyone got into line. So that was 1971. Everyone knew that if you spoke your mind anymore, to stay in that business, you had to go over to the other, to their side. And that's, I think, when music turned, they say that's when Laurel Canyon, became satanic. Essentially, you basically had to sign a contract in blood, and sell your soul to be a rock star. But before that, it had been much more of a, much more of an organic and innocent, spontaneous phenomenon. But by that time, many people were, already dead, crazy.
Well, that tradition of selling your soul to the devil goes back to Robert Johnson, though, so it's much older as a tradition.
But that, I think, would have been a different... Yeah, and Bob Dylan says he did too. But I think when Johnson says he went down to the crossroads and met the devil, that's a very different thing from walking into Alan Klein's office.
Well, it's the archetypal versus the literal again. Yeah. And maybe that's a big part of what social engineering is, in fact, is literalizing the archetypal. They're trying to actually copy the gods.
Oh, Jason, it could be. Well, yeah, we're living in a copy, a universe now of everything's fake and facsimile.
The counterfeit, yeah. So yeah. what would Oldham think of any of this, do you think? Or what would you think of what I write about in Vice Kings and about the London School of Economics bankrolling the Rolling Stones? Or, you know, how far is he willing to go out on that paranoid limb?
I was hoping you would ask him that. Mm. I was hoping that you would. And in fact, you know, it's not easy to access him, and he's in his 70s now, and I don't feel like I can just, you know, I've sent him a couple of emails. He's responded. I wanted to tell him, I think, you know, I was keen on finding some way for him to talk about you and your book. I did use you as a reference in my first paper that I wrote. You know, so I used the Vice of Kings as a reference, but I don't think it got past the TA. I don't think anyone saw that paper. So I'm thinking, how can I talk to Oldham? I wanted him to know about you. I wanted you to know about him. So that's as far as things have gone right now. I guess I was thinking you should have him on your show.
Yeah. Sure, but like you're my intro to him, so I want to find out if, you know, I don't want to talk to a stone wall who's just going to say, oh, you're one of those lunatics, or even be more polite about it.
So you want to know if he's open to you. You know what he said last week? Last week he seemed, I think he was aware of my blog last week. There'd be a reason why. And so there was a kind of response in the class, and he turned to, well, there's 250 people, 220 people in the room, right? Every now and then he seems to have picked me. I ask questions sometimes, and I'm one of the oldest people in the room, and so I'm a white-haired lady. And so every now and then he'll address a remark to me, and just briefly, I just get it that he's looking straight at me and he's saying something. He said, this week he played an old rock tune, Dion DiMucci or something, one of those early like 60s. And he said, you know what? It's all brainwashing. And he just looked straight at me and almost pointed. Yeah. You know, the music, even he's open to it. I don't think he's read everything. I think some of it, he's been living in Colombia for the last, I don't know, for how long, 30 years. So, but I think you'd find if you didn't repel each other that you would have a lot in common. Mm. You know, it might take a little while. He's pretty you know, he's pretty brittle. He can be quite, you know, but interesting guy.
What's your impression of him in terms of his conscious complicity with this? I mean, because if he was shaping the Rolling Stones image right at the start, then he was certainly complicit. So how conscious do you think he was?
Well, I've been treading very carefully. I'm actually trying to get through his, I read his second book first, and then I read, which, because it's set later on in the, after 65. And now and then I started reading his first book, and I got a little stuck. I want to continue when I want to finish it, just to have more of a sense of him, because what he's been able to do is introduce us to his time, his era. And once you know someone, then you understand what motivates them. And I've come to understand his childhood well, which means the childhood of the Beatles and Rolling Stones, and it's pre your era. So the 50s, the rubble in the streets, you know, the rationing and the incredible repression and the fathers with shell shock who are refusing to talk to their kids, and I guess a lot of domestic violence and a lot of misery, and MKUltra came out of that, you know, as you know. So once you understand those, and the mods and the rockers and the violence, and how they adopted American rock music as their salvation, as a chance to maybe get to America and have a lawn and a Cadillac and a house in the suburbs. How desperate in a way England was and depressed, and then came this music and they grabbed it. It was a lifeline, and more than it, probably any American would have grabbed onto rock and roll the way they just needed it, and they lived it. It's really, he's been able to really bring that. I wasn't aware of all of that. And then, he didn't have a father really. His father died. His father was an Air Force man. And his mother just managed to support them. He was into fashion. I was obviously gay from the time he was young. I mean, I don't know, he's the type of kid you would have, but in those days you didn't say you were gay and you didn't know you were gay. And so he gravitated to all these old stars who were living in walk-ups and they would let him in and pour him a glass of sherry and tell them all about their lives. And he was just a total freak for music, entertainment, show business. And that's how he got into it. So a real operator and a salesman more than anything more, that's why he was able to succeed. He could sell anything and he could talk people, persuade people. And so, when he connected with the Stones, he just had a formula for them that just worked. He's really brilliant, actually. So it lasted for 2 years. I am sure that he's talked about his mushroom experiences and talking, he's a Castaneda type guy too. In Colombia, he communes with the ghost of Brian Jones, and it's different, he's been on the dark side, there's no question, but he knows it and he can talk about it, and he survived. It's multifaceted. It's been a great course. It's been the best thing that's happened to me in a long time, actually. And so last week you showed us some film about the Who, and I, for the first time, I got the Who, what they were all about, and they're all about war, post-war trauma, desperation, inarticulate suffering that found an outlet. And I suddenly understood their music. I never did before. So, England, I think. He lives around here. So he lives somewhere in the hills up here. You have a chance.
Does he seem like a good guy to you?
I'm getting to like him. At first, I was scared of him. I very quickly realized he was Jagger's lover. That's a huge thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's even, it's known, it's rumored. I don't know if it's really publicized. I don't know if it's something you're allowed to say, but I saw it recently somewhere in a book I was reading just yesterday, that he rumored to have been, Andrew Lowe, was something I was reading yesterday. Hmm. And that would have been immediately after the Stones came to Montreal in 65, that they would have started that relationship.
Hmm.
Probably on the road in America. So it's, the way my mind works, it's all a little, I love following timelines and stories and what do they do next, and where do they go from there? And so now I've remembered the Stones in Montreal. That's been a very important thing for me to have reconnected with that. I remember that time, April 1965. But I have a much better sense of why the Stones became so important to me, later, but also at that time they were, except I was never a fan. I've never someone who went to Stones concerts or wore their gear or said I was into the Stones. I never would I have, camped out all night to get a ticket or you know, live the, taking the, I mean, the drugs and the whole thing. No, that was not my scene at all. So I was never a Stones fan, but I had this sense of some kind of strange relationship with Mick Jagger. Always throughout my, you know, throughout my life, I had a sense of some kind of psychic connection. And I understand, I'm learning more about that now, partly through getting to know Alden.
Have you mentioned it to him?
Well, yeah, I have. I sent him an email where, I've brought it up. He kind of would be aware. Yeah, he'd be aware of me, and not necessarily somebody, but someone that he wants to engage with, but I wanted him to be aware of that. Yeah. And it's useful. I mean, how many of us are still alive? How many people remember seeing the Stones on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964? I remember it like it was yesterday. I went into school completely, you know, zombified from that, completely, like, and then I found there were other people, other girls around me who it had the same experience, you know, and we never got over it. And so how many of us are left? I mean,
What if he hears this podcast?
What if he hears this?
Yeah,
I don't know. It'd be nice if he did, you know.
Well, I'm sure he can. I mean, this can be easily arranged if it becomes a podcast and I invite him on. That would be one of the things I'd say. Well, listen to this.
I wonder if he knows about you by now.
Maybe via your citations in your paper.
Not yet. I haven't. No, just one citation wouldn't be enough. But I wanted to nudge him over, you know. Anyway, it might still happen.
I'm certainly open to it. I'm, as you've probably noticed, observed, I'm moving out of the dark now and into the light as far as what I focus, put my attention on. There's only so much time left. But that doesn't mean that.
But Jason.
Yeah. You know, I've closed the door on hell. Yeah, I'm not all the way out.
No, but see, that's the whole point of this. Is that our generation, mine and yours too, experienced hell. I think we did. I think we made a pretty good tour of hell. I was a goody two shoes for a lot of my life, but I did, you know, yeah, even me. And you couldn't avoid it, and it's just who we are and who we need to be. And it's only when you pass through those stages and get to the, you know, and you finally get to the roof of the building and you look down and you realize, well, you're in heaven, you always were, or you always could have been here, but you chose instead to pass through all the rooms. That's because you're at a point in time where we need to recuperate, you know, or what do you call that? Remaster all of human history. You can't just say, well, you know, the way Christians say, well, that's a pagan, you know, that's a pagan tradition, or that's, you know, that's demonic, and, you know, and I don't go there. But that's just bullshit. That's not where we were supposed to embrace Satan in this time and understand it, be wise as serpents, and come out the other end.
As harmless as doves. Yeah.
What?
As harmless as doves out the other end.
Oh, now that. Well, you. Anyway, yes, you're looking sort of more harmless these days. Why so terrified of all that lies out? Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm not going to argue with any of that. It's a question of not getting snagged on the way out, isn't it? Because there's going to be a tendency to... There's still tricks and traps and, you know, booby traps and mines to set off and this, right? So don't just...
Somehow they just seem so trivial, though. They're not when you're up against them, but...
I think it's... Maybe it's back to the thing of, you know, are we over-complexifying or complicating things? Like trying to make sense of something that will never make sense, for example, like... trying to make one's past make sense, even, and that's a very small thing in the, you know, in the grand scheme of things. Like, we were just a couple of souls out of billions who ended up ensnared in this matrix. You know, our past will never add up in any fully satisfying way. We'll never be able to put all the memories together. So it's just letting go of a certain kind of drive. Psychic driving, even, and keeping up, being alert to things that re-stimulate it. Right. So, as far as the podcast, like, you know, who do I talk to? I've always been very cautious about that. Anyway, but it's weird. I mean, I'd say I'm in a way I'm less cautious now because I feel like it's time to take risks now that I've really found my footing. I can really do some moves. You know. So yeah, I want to take all the risks, but not unnecessary risks and not self-indulgent risks. Right. So, and the larger question here, I think, maybe, and because it's been in the back of my mind for a while, is you know, can anyone really understand what we're talking about here, the MK culture, if you're not on the inside? And we're not, and we don't want to be. You and I are, I mean, it's one thing we have in common, seems, perhaps you more than me, I'm not sure, but half in and half out.
Yeah.
You have seen a lot from the inside. I think I have too. Even if I failed to actually access it, as you did, really, I had a lot of the handshakes and the keys. I just self-sabotaged constantly because I really knew I didn't want in. I was actually trying to get out. Right.
Well, I always wanted out because, you know, I told you that dream, the whole point, that dream of the mansion, of going, entering this house. I mean, I didn't want to live in that house. I knew I had to keep moving from room to room and eventually, you know, get out of there. I think at heart I am a Christian, or I'm with, you know, but I'm impatient with people that don't want to, you know, they don't want to do the work, or they don't want to, or they reject, you know, they distance themselves from people who are, you know, embroiled in all the dark stuff, because I think that's just a false position to be in, you know. What's the point of always being in the light? Okay, stay in heaven and don't incarnate and just be with God and, you know, but what would be the point? Why come to earth? You know, unless you're going to get your hands dirty, so.
Sure, well, you know, well there, but this, so I mean, on that metaphor, yeah, I'm not saying I'm avoiding the dark, because what's the point in being light if you can't penetrate the dark? I mean, what's my orientation? Where's my attention? So it's like the attention.
Well, I think it's about confidence too, and feeling strong enough that you're not going to be overwhelmed, that if you do encounter, you know, if you've, say, you know, the dance metaphor, you know, you meet a partner who's an Iron Man and just, you know, crushes you, you know, that's not the kind of, you don't want that to happen. When you're dancing, you want to be able, you want it to be a give and take, and you want to be able to, you know, but creative tension is really important, you know, and conflict, and not knowing what the outcome's going to be when you engage yourself in something, not knowing if you're going to, all those things are, you know, they're worth it. They're worth doing. I mean, you can't stay pure. You can't be enlightened all the time. I'm sorry, but, you know.
Well, I can't. I mean, I don't know. I'll get back to you if I get enlightened. I think Dave's emphasis is that it's collective enlightenment. There's no such thing as individual enlightenment. So, yeah, right. There could be no completely enlightened human at this time, because obviously the majority are greatly in darkened. And yeah, when we can't fly off to some other dimension and leave the rest of our body parts behind. Absolutely. So it's, again, it's more about knowing one's limitations. You know, I don't want to talk to this Oldham or whoever if I've still got a certain amount of fascination there that's going to ensnare me and make the conversation not, you know, not productive. You know, whatever. It's, yeah, it's knowing my limits. Knowing
right.
My limits.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I'm not
being able to laugh, you know.
Yeah, be light in one form or another. I'm not a big joker, as you know, but one can be light in other ways. So yeah, I mean, I'm quite open to it. I mean, I'm interested in reading his book from what you just said, although I barely read anymore, but maybe it's in the library, maybe I can check it out and get a sense of him.
I bet you can, and they've actually, I haven't been yet, but the university here is setting up a kind of collection of things he's donated, and I haven't had a chance to go over, but I think that's something I'd like to do before they close the place down for virus. But
right.
Yeah, he's I don't know what it all is, memorabilia. It's not just that. It's, I think it's papers and books and music and all sorts of stuff. The collection. Lug. Oldham collection at Thompson Rivers University.
I'll look into it. Whether he's in the library. On this question of being on the inside and the outside, I also just mentioned Dave. There's a thing that he wrote to me recently that I just wanted to get your intuitive response on, because it's been an ongoing dilemma for me. And this is what he wrote. I thought yesterday, as an aside, that fearing that anything with mass appeal is popular only because it has been supported by tainters puts a ceiling on taking something to the masses, as in to the masses, tarred and feathered by your own brush, crippled, hobbled, and nobbled. So, do you know what he's referring to there, or do you want
does
me
he
to...
say? Tainters?
Tainters, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh.
The social engineers.
Yeah, I was thinking, I had that thought. I don't know why I had the same thought. I was shopping a couple of hours ago and I was thinking we might talk about something to do that, about not having a, yeah, I was having that conversation with myself about how some people end up with a huge audience, you know, and other people have a small audience. But I was thinking the reason you don't have a big audience, or I don't have an audience for most of what I do, you know, whether I deserve one or not, I don't know, but is that you didn't connect with salesperson.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't connect, you know, you didn't, Jagger connected with Oldham. Jagger's a creative, you know, but but not a marketer necessarily. He found a marketer and suddenly it's just explosive, you know, what you could do. But then you'd be forced to deal with the fallout of having an audience and many of the people that you wouldn't want to know, who are being drawn in by the sales pitch. It may not have anything to do with you, who you really are. Whereas when you remain true to yourself, you'll probably only find other people who are, you know, able, you're, you know, you would normally be able to connect with because they're interested in that kind of truth. And that's what I found, you know, that I was unable to, I wrote a book that I was told should have a mass audience about MK Ultra, you know, 15 years ago. And I was blocked from any kind of, I didn't manage to find any publisher, anyone who would be interested in selling it. But I found myself connecting through some sort of intuitive network. I met the people I needed to meet. And I, you know, there was a certain response. That's really all I really wanted to do. I didn't necessarily, I don't know whether it was a failure or whether it's just, that's just the way it is. I mean, and I think you too could, you know, you probably could find a wide audience, but you wouldn't necessarily be telling them, you know, wouldn't be delivering the same message to them. Would that be would it be worth your trouble to then have to sort out, you know, who's worth talking to, who's getting it, who's repeating it back to you, a completely distorted, completely sick kind of a way that you've then got to, you know, sort out and clean up and so on. You know, I mean, that's, so think of the Rolling Stones. I mean, they had somehow the solidity and the strength. I still do think they are a great band and a great leaders in a way of a generation, but they certainly didn't look like it 30 years ago. You know, the people that followed them were not, and that were with, have been with them all the way, were some of those, you know, some just, I think, some pretty disgusting characters, you know, and there was a whole sewer sort of side to the whole thing that I chose not to get involved in. I didn't want to go there, but at the same time, I recently would travel to a couple of their concerts in Ontario, and then went to Boston, and traveling with people who have been into the Stones all their lives, and you know, the ones that lived, the ones that didn't die, the ones that got through it are pretty interesting characters. I mean, more than interesting. So that's the whole thing in life. It's not choosing light or choosing to be on the good guys and to come out a winner. It's being ready to just endure, you know, and go through it. And eventually, you know, you will arrive where you're supposed to be. You know, didn't you see what I'm saying? And so maybe at some point too, you will strike it rich and find your marketer, you know, find your marketing person who will make you an international sage, you know?
I think we have to be open to everything, don't we? Even success.
I mean, like something become, but do you want to be that? Do you want to be Chogyam Trungpa?
No, I mean, you know? No, I don't. But that doesn't mean it might not be useful. I do want to reach more people, because I want to reach more of the right people. So even if there's only another 100 of them out there, I'd like to reach them, but they're all spread out, you know, and so. So yeah, I don't want to. I feel as though it's possible. I do have a self-sabotaging program, and it would be brilliant, wouldn't it, of the social engineers to indoctrinate the more conscious of us with the idea that any kind of success or large-scale influence would be proof that we'd been co-opted and corrupted, because then that would be a way to neutralize us.
Yeah. Right. So, but it's kind of a false dichotomy in the end, you know, fame, not fame.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's not a polarity, but numbers are somewhat real. And I can count the hits, and I know that I don't make a dime off my books. And, you know, there are some basic realities that can be calculated and. Well, they're evidence of something. I like to think of them as evidence of my integrity, but I don't think that's, you know, that probably lacks integrity, that perspective. I think they're evidence of a number of different things.
I don't know, it just seems, yeah, it is what it is. It'll work itself out as it works itself out. You'll reach out, you'll, you know, however many people you connect to, how many do they connect to after, you know, and...
Yeah.
Some teachers stay very small.
Yeah.
They still have a huge impact. Maybe more so, more than, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's ironically that's Dave. Dave's platform is very small, reaches very few.
Mm-hmm. Seems to be not a question, not even a question. Oh, you know. Anyway, I would just, you know, I mean. Concretely, I mean, I studied with Leonard Cohen's Roshi, you know, Sasaki Roshi. Now I think he had a total of about 5,000 students. It's not that small, but pretty small. Whereas, you know, then at one point when Chogyam Trungpa was starting to get sick, he went to the Roshi. He was just drinking himself, and you know, he had like huge, I don't know how many people, and they were celebrities and all sorts of people, but thousands and thousands of students. And huge, you know, many books, everyone was buying his books and so on. But he was a mess. So he was 45 or something, and he went to see the Roshi, and who said to him, we were told, if you don't become my student, you're going to be dead in 5 years. And exactly 5 years later, he died. He didn't come, you know, and study on the mountain with the Roshi and clean his act up. You know, he just continued on with his, you know, he had that type of personality, and people loved him, but they also hated him, and they were afraid of him, and he was completely out of control. And, you know, I never met him in the end. I was warned by Leonard Cohen not to get close to that guy, you know, but I had friends who were. And in the end, which is better? I have no, it seems like it's just two sides of the same, you know?
I think, yeah.
The Roshi lived to be 105 or 107. Chogyam Trungpa died at 48.
I think it's back to that thing, isn't it? The double psychic driving. One can be driven to be a failure and driven to be a success, and neither one will be our destiny, because it'll just be programming. So I just don't want to close any doors, you know, of destiny because of anything. I just want to be
certainly
everything.
Not because of your own judgment. You wouldn't want to show. You wouldn't want to prevent yourself through some, you know, fear-based or whatever.
Conviction.
Reticence, yeah. Conviction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Belief. You know. But who knows?
Who knows? We'll leave it as a question mark. That'll make it easier to speak to Oldham, because then I don't have to assume that he's an arch conspirator just because he was so successful.
Oh, did you assume that? Well, I bet. Well, he was. But I think he was crushed. That's, you know, and then he just kind of crawled off to Colombia and then he kind of hid out there. He was, and became a total alcoholic, I think, too. And then finally in 96, on a trip to New York, he met an old friend who said, "You are just a drunk. That's what you are." And at that point, something clicked and he started pulling himself up. He's written these, I think he's become quite an amazing character. I don't know how much longer he's going to be able to do this, but what he knows, you know, and can articulate, and much of it's he's very egocentric, you know, and then he isn't, you know. So we're all works in progress. I'm just happy to see people. I just love to see people, I don't know, recover their childhood a little bit, open up, change, you know. People that we condemn as being satanic, you know, I love it when suddenly you see they're not really. Well, they were children at one point, and they were broken, probably. That's probably what happened. You know?
Well, that's a very strong note to end on, actually. I've got to go into the kitchen and prepare dinner before my wife returns. So.
Want to get to my glass of wine? You won't let me drink.
Now you can. Yeah. Now you're free to.
The whole university could shut down. Who knows at this point? Right. So we may have had our last class with him, and it just was so sublime. I'm understanding rock and roll finally, and it's not what I thought, you know.
Well, that's anyway. High praise.
Yep. Changes in the heart, changes the time. Strangers in the night pass up and down town. Changes in your soul.
There ends this conversation with Anne Diamond. Please support this podcast any way you know how. Participate, join the Zoom live events, comment, donate in the widget bar at the website, buy and review my books, or just send me some love. Changes in the heart, change with the times.
change with the night. Strangers in the heart, stay up until light. Dangers in your soul, they motion.